History of the Crusades. Episode 250, the Baltic Crusades, the Livonian Crusade, Part 37, the early 1270s. Hello again. Last week we saw the end of the Second Prussian Insurrection, a pagan uprising which started after the Order's defeat at the Battle of Durba and ended 15 or so years later in 1274. This week we are returning to Livonia. Last time we checked in on Livonia was back in episode 246. Master Otto had managed to put an end to Russian invasions into Estonia and had also managed to put an end to Archbishop Albert Suebir, who he ordered imprisoned after the Archbishop's failed attempt to conspire to overthrow the Teutonic Order in Livonia. With the Russian threat over for now, and with Archbishop Albert sitting powerless in his residence in Riga, meekly doing the Order's bidding, we shall now return back to Livonia. Now, I guess it won't surprise anyone to learn that Master Otto, having dealt with the Russians and with Riga's Archbishop, turned his attentions back to the pagans. In the year 1269, he began recruiting and planning for a massive invasion into Semigalia. In early 1270, when the winter freeze made it easier to travel over the frozen ice, he assembled a large force in Riga, and they headed off towards Semigalia. They had no sooner started their march, however, when word came in that Livonia itself was under attack. Word of the mobilisation of the Latin Christian army must have reached the pagans, who attacked Livonia on two fronts simultaneously, with the Samogitians gathering at the border preparing to invade, and the Lithuanians travelling over the ice to the north and attacking the island of Isil. With his plan to invade Semigalia now shelved for the moment, Master Otto decided to deal with the Lithuanians first. He called on reinforcements from his Danish vassals in Estonia and from the Archbishopric of Dorpat, then moved his army northwards, intending to confront the Lithuanians as they returned from Isil, laden down with booty. Now, this campaign wasn't a terribly pleasant one to be part of. Master Otto didn't know where in Livonia or Courland the Lithuanians intended to march back onto land, so the only way to intercept the pagans was for the Order to march its army across the frozen Gulf of Riga and meet the Lithuanians close to Isil as they rode across the ice. Most, if not all, of the men and horses of the army marching under Master Otto suffered mightily from the cold and exposure as they moved across the vast frozen expanse of the Gulf. Finally, they spotted the Lithuanians returning from their raid on Isil. The Lithuanians, who had a number of sleds which were being pulled by horses, uncoupled the sleds from the horses and lashed them together, forming a sort of sleddy defensive barrier. The Lithuanian army moved into position behind the sleds and waited to see what would happen next. Master Otto convened a quick war council, and it was decided that the Latin Christian army would move into battle formation and would charge the stationary Lithuanian forces. What occurred then was a spectacular battle on the ice. The Gulf of Riga must have been covered with a really thick layer of ice, as the ice held under a cavalry charge by the heavy war horses of the Knights of the Order's army. However, the centre of the charge broke as it descended upon the sled barrier erected by the Lithuanians. The war horses became entangled in the sleds and were surrounded by the Lithuanians, who swarmed out from behind their barrier to attack the faltering charges. The forces to either side of the centre, the men under the command of the Bishop of Dorpat, who were fighting to the left, and the Danish vassals on the right, were engaged heavily with the Lithuanians themselves and were unable to come to the assistance of the men of the Order who were fighting in the centre. As a consequence, the Order suffered heavy losses, with one of the 53 men from the Teutonic Order who were killed that day being Master Otto himself. Here's what the Livonian Rhymed Chronicle has to say about the battle, and I quote, "One could see a disorderly tumult of the two armies, Christian and heathen. The battle was hard fought, and the blood flowed onto the ice from either side. It was a fight in which many noblemen were struck down. Slain in defeat was good Master Otto and 52 good brothers. They spilled their blood for God. Also, many outstanding chivalrous warriors on both sides fell. Part of the natives fell. May God save their souls." End quote. Now, as the fighters from the Teutonic Order were suffering a major defeat around the sled barrier, the forces of the bishop and the Danish Estonians pushed back the Lithuanians to either side of the centre. But both of these forces, instead of coming to the aid of the Order, decided to pursue the fleeing Lithuanians across the ice. In his book The Baltic Crusade, William Urban reports that eventually these forces stopped chasing the pagans and regrouped, finally coming to the aid of the struggling Latin Christian forces fighting around the sled barrier, which meant that the infantry forces fighting under the Order's command were saved from being massacred. By the time night fell, the losses were 600 Latin Christian dead, along with 1,600 pagans, but the Lithuanians had the upper hand. The bishop took command and ordered the Latin Christians to retreat, which they did, heading back across the ice to Riga. The Lithuanians were then able to untangle their sleds, reattach them to their horses, and head back home themselves, successfully bringing with them all their booty from Esel, along with heaps of weapons and armour they had stripped from the dead Latin Christians. William Urban notes that the victory scored by the Lithuanians raised the prestige of their army significantly and resulted in a wave of new recruits joining the army. Now, following Master Otto's death, the position of Master of the Teutonic Order in Livonia was filled by Master Otto's deputy, Vice Master Andreas of Westphalia, as an interim measure until a new permanent master could be appointed by Grand Master Anno. A few months into his role as temporary master, Vice Master Andreas decided that the Teutonic Knights could do with a morale-boosting victory. So, in the summer of 1270, when word came in that a group of Lithuanian raiders were rampaging through Livonian territory, Vice Master Andreas spotted an opportunity. Hastily gathering together a small force of knights, Vice Master Andreas and his small army set off in hot pursuit of the Lithuanians, keen to intercept them before they disappeared back into the Lithuanian forests. In fact, hot pursuit was the correct term to use here, in more ways than one. Charging around the Livonian borderlands in full armour in the middle of summer ended up being an exhausting way to spend your time, so Vice Master Andreas paused for a while to let his fighters rest, probably also allowing them to remove their suits of armour. I guess you know what's going to happen next. Yes, the Lithuanians sprung out of a nearby forest and surprised the Latin Christian fighters as they were resting, managing to kill 20 of them, including Vice Master Andreas. As a morale booster, it's pretty clear that Vice Master Andreas's plan was a complete flop. Unsurprisingly, since his two predecessors had both been recently killed in battle, the new master for Livonia, Walter of Nortigern, was much more cautious when it came to fighting the pagans. It wasn't until early 1271, when he had gathered together a large army, that he set out on his first campaign against the pagans, choosing to attack a Semigallian stronghold, a castle called Tverton, which the Semigallians had constructed near Mittau. The campaign was well planned and well supported, and was a resounding success, with the knights from the order successfully storming and taking the Semigallian stronghold following a short siege. Buoyed by this success, Master Walter made preparations to push deeper into Semigallia to Masotin, the former seat of the Bishop of Semigallia. Around Easter in the year 1271, he sent a number of ships upriver to Masotin, and to his surprise, the Semigallians at Masotin promptly surrendered without putting up a fight. He sailed his troops a little further upriver to another Semigallian stronghold, and that too surrendered without a fuss. The Semigallians who had capitulated at Tverton, Masotin, and in the surrounding areas all agreed to pay taxes and tithes, and also agreed not to take up arms against the order. While this was all well and good, we should remember that the vast majority of Semigallia was still under pagan control, as was Samogitia and most of Curland. So, while Master Walter had made some inroads into the pagan problem, there was still much work left to be done. But this work won't be done by Master Walter. The cold climate and the tough living conditions took a great toll on Master Walter's health, and in the year 1273 he returned to the Holy Roman Empire and asked to be relieved of his duties. His resignation was accepted, and a new master, Ernest of Rusburg, was appointed. Grand Master Anno died shortly after seeing Master Ernest appointed, and a new Grand Master was eventually chosen, Grand Master Hartmann, who had a minor connection to the Baltic Crusades, as he had been present when the Sword Brothers merged with the Teutonic Order. Okay, now before we proceed to follow Master Ernest's career in Livonia, I think it's time we stepped back a little and took a look at the big picture. Now, as we've been seeing for a while now, things haven't been so great internally in the Kingdom of Denmark, the Holy Roman Empire, or in Poland. By the early 1270s, a general meh sort of feeling had descended over these states, and whereas in previous generations the countries of northern Central Europe had spawned ambitious, energized men who were keen to get things moving and to expand out of their comfort zones and take up the cross on crusade, William Urban notes in his book The Baltic Crusade that things had really settled down to a sort of despondency and exhaustion around this time. So instead of crusading or trying to further their interests by other means, the noblemen of Denmark, Poland, and the northern regions of the Holy Roman Empire just sort of sat around hoping that things would start to get better. This meh feeling deepened with the failure of the crusade of King Louis IX in August 1270, when the pious French king led a large and eager force on crusade to Egypt with the aim of retaking Jerusalem, only to see the whole expedition face-planting after an epidemic of dysentery struck the crusaders after they arrived in Tunisia, killing many Latin Christians, including King Louis. So, really, no one could be bothered with the whole crusading caper in the early 1270s. And William Urban notes that this attitude resulted in the isolation of the Scandinavian kingdoms and the Baltic region from the rest of Europe continuing. In the unlikely event that anyone from Central Europe was struck with a crusading zeal at this point in time, they tended to head to Prussia and not to Livonia or Estonia. So Livonia was left pretty much to its own devices. But that didn't mean that Livonia was joining in the general stagnation occurring in Central Europe. In fact, almost the opposite was occurring. While crusading was on the wane in Central Europe, and while there was a general lack of anything exciting happening, there was one spark of activity which stood out in the gloom. Trade in the cities on the Baltic Sea was booming. Lübeck was continuing to grow in power and influence, and it was fostering trading towns across the Baltic region. Towns such as Danzig or Gdansk, Kulm and Elbing all fell under Lübeck's wing, as did the towns of Riga, Dorpat and Reval in Livonia and Estonia. It was like a boat on a rising tide. As Lübeck rose, it pulled a bunch of other boats in the form of trading towns in Prussia, Livonia, and Estonia up with it. There was one city, however, which didn't rise with the other boats. Having enjoyed dizzying success as a crusader supply outpost and stepping stone to Riga, the city of Visby started to fade out of view at this time, as many merchants bypassed Gotland entirely, travelling straight along the Baltic coastline to trading centres in Prussia, Livonia and Estonia. Trade in Livonia was boosted, inadvertently perhaps, by the actions of the Teutonic Order at this time. Following the death of Archbishop Albert Suebeer, the order wasn't too keen on anything which enhanced the power of the bishops in their territories. Instead, they showered favours on the merchants, hoping to keep the bishops and archbishops in check by empowering the mercantile classes. William Urban states that, following the demise of Archbishop Albert, the Teutonic Order encouraged the independence of citizens within its domains, particularly the citizens of Riga, helping them to stand up against the bishops and granting them various immunities and trading privileges. While this did have the effect of empowering the merchants and weakening the authority of the church in the region, with many bishops in Livonia in fact deciding to reside in the Holy Roman Empire instead of in their bishoprics, it may have been too successful a plan, as the merchant classes will become so wealthy and powerful in Riga that they will eventually come to threaten the dominance of the Teutonic Order itself. So, in a nutshell, Riga at this point in time is booming as a trading centre, as are other trading cities around the Baltic coastline. But crusading as a way of getting Central Europeans to travel to Livonia to assist in battles against the pagans is on the decline, meaning that the Latin Christians of Livonia are being forced to provide most of the manpower for their military campaigns themselves. So, the new master of Livonia, Master Ernest, is going to have to draw on local Latin Christian manpower as he battles to take on the Semigallians, the Samogitians, and the Lithuanians. Join me next week to see how Master Ernest fares as he presides over the Teutonic Order in Livonia for the remainder of the 1270s. Until next week, bye for now. This podcast is powered by Patreon. If you can spare $1 per month and would like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com and search for History of the Crusades, or go to our website, crusadespod.com, and click on the Patreon link. Your $1 contribution will mean you get access to an extra episode every fortnight on topics related to the Crusades. And it means that you are powering the History of the Crusades podcast. Thank you to all who have signed up so far.